Here in the NBC studios in Denver is Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn, noted news analyst, to bring you his regular summary of the latest dispatches from the war capitals. Mr. Kaltenborn.
Good morning, everybody, and good afternoon, too. I'm happy to be here in Denver. Even a streamliner sometimes breaks down, and I was caught 200 miles out of Denver this morning with no chance of getting here, and then suddenly succeeded in chartering a plane from Sterling, Colorado, and flying in. But once again, I was almost stopped because the airport people thought that I was an escaping bank robber and had to check up with station KOA before they'd let me land and come in. But here we are, and now to the news. President Roosevelt charged today that opponents of his National Solidarity Cabinet are acting from partisan rather than patriotic motives. And it looks this morning as though instead of unifying the country, for the time being at least, the two appointments which were so unexpectedly announced yesterday are going to create a great deal of political palaver. Colonel Frank Knox announced today that he has accepted the nomination as Secretary of the Navy because, quote, the President has said that I can help him. Newspapers in London interpret President Roosevelt's appointment of Henry L. Stimson and Frank Knox as chief of our service departments as meaning a real intensification of American aid to the Allies and as possibly presaging eventual American entry to the war. Obviously, that is the basis on which those appointments are being attacked in this country, and you can depend upon it that skillful politicians will quote the London press for all they're worth in order to emphasize that point of view. The London Daily Mail says the President's action is a warning that the United States really does mean business. Now is not the time to speculate on America's further intentions, but be sure that the signs will be read by Hitler and Mussolini. Note the discretion of the editor of the Daily Mail. He knows something about politics in this country, and he doesn't want to say anything that can be used by the politicians to indicate that this means America's approach towards war. The Senate Military Committee today agreed unanimously to hold meetings on President Roosevelt's nominations after July 1st. At any rate, they won't hold them for something more than a week. Congress, as you know, is adjourned for the Republican National recess, rather, for the Republican National Convention, and they have decided to hold hearings on the appointments. Stimson will be called before the committee for questioning at his convenience after the conclusion of the Republican National Convention. And the nomination of Colonel Knox is scheduled to be considered by the Senate Naval Affairs Committee tomorrow. In any case, there will be some delay in final confirmation by the Senate. Today's historic news tells us that the terms for an armistice between France and Germany were handed this time by Germany to France in that same historic wagon-lit car, which for more than a score of years has stood as a museum of the memorable occasion when France dictated terms to Germany at the conclusion of the World War. The German Chancellor stood in that historic dining car of the Wagon-Lit Company, where France imposed terms on Germany. He stood silently before the French delegates, and Colonel General Wilhelm Keitel, the German commander, read to these delegates a preamble to the conditions of the armistice. And when that had been ended, Führer Hitler brought up his arm in the Nazi salute, while the French commissioners, headed by General Hunzinger, who, Alsatian-born, is fluent in speaking German, stood at military attention. The ceremony was all over in 10 minutes, and then the French delegates, in facilities provided by Germany, gathered to discuss the German terms. Telephones were made available to them, and over these telephones, the terms will be communicated to the French government at Bordeaux. A preamble to the armistice conditions was read to the French by General Keitel, the German chief of staff. And let us consider for a moment that preamble. The first point made in it is Germany must have assurances that would prevent the resumption of battle. That means that Germany insists on the complete surrender of every possibility of French fighting that is still in French hands. Second, France must give Germany all assurances for waging the Reich's war against Great Britain. This means that France must not only surrender to Germany all the war material that she has, all the possibility she has of waging war herself, but that she must grant to Germany all territorial and other facilities which will make it possible for Germany to use French territory, French raw materials, French resources for the continuance of the fight against Britain. And condition number three, prerequisites must be established for a new peace which will provide restitution to Germany for the wrongs done Germany by force. This means restitution both territorial and material. It suggests reparations in kind, if not in gold. It indicates that when the terms of peace are finally presented to France by Germany, they will probably be no whit less harsh than those which France presented to Germany herself. Possibly, in one respect, they will be less harsh. They may not require France to admit that she was solely responsible for the war. The preamble restated Hitler's long-established thesis that Germany had not lost the war in 1918, but that the war was lost by the stab in the back. Every German that I've talked to since the war, in the score of times that I have been in Germany, has mentioned that stab in the back, and particularly after Hitler came into power, it was the one excuse, the one reason why they had lost the war. That Germany's post-war suffering stemmed in inevitable consequence from these causes. Well, obviously, the war itself was not the only defeat that Germany suffered. Germany suffered defeat in a number of ways. Morally, she was down. Morally, she found it extremely difficult to rehabilitate herself. But it was this platform of Hitler's that brought him to power in Germany, and with that logic, which he has shown in a great many of his actions, Hitler restated it today in the terms of peace that he presented to the French. What dishonor and debasement, says the armistice preamble, what human and material suffering that could be inflicted against a people was begun here. Now let's be frank and say, that's true, it was a harsh peace. It was, in some respects, an unjust peace. And the preamble continues, perjury and a breach of promise conspired against a people which, after more than 4 years of historic resistance, succumbed to only a single weakness, belief in the promises of democratic statesmen. That is not true. That, of course, is the attempt of the Germans to pretend that they could have fought on, that they could still have continued the war. They might have continued it, but they were in just about the same shape that France is in today. They had lost the possibility of a continued offensive. The Allied offensive was progressing at an extremely rapid rate, and there isn't a particle of doubt that in a few weeks the Allies would have been in Berlin if the war had continued. And if Germany did lay down her arms as a result of the 14 points of Woodrow Wilson being imposed as the basis for the armistice, nevertheless, even if they had not done that, they would have been defeated and they would have had to accept the victor's terms. That also must be remembered in this present attempt of Adolf Hitler to once again distort the truths of history. For unless we get the truths of history definitely established in our minds when they favor the Germans and when they favor the French, we'll never reach a position where there can be common agreement by sane men on the kind of peace that will have a chance to last. For it is only a balanced peace that will ever last between Germany and France. England and France. On September 3rd, 1939, the German preamble goes on, again declared war against Germany without any grounds. That's not true. They declared war most reluctantly. They should have declared it 4 years sooner. They should have declared it when Hitler began his policy of aggression. They were so patient, so willing to appease, so willing to make concessions, that they sacrificed their chance to defeat the Hitler regime in its early stages before it was strong because of their love of peace. So here again, a willful distortion by Hitler of the actual truth. At the moment of the arrival of the German Armistice Commission, the preamble goes on, there began the breach of a solemnly given promise. November 11th, 1918 began in this train the time of suffering of the German people. And then it goes on, recites more history, and finally this paragraph. France has been beaten in a series of bloody battles after heroic resistance and has collapsed. Germany does not intend, therefore, to lend to the armistice conditions or the armistice negotiations the character of abuse of so valiant an opponent. Well, perhaps the negotiations will be made a little more easy for the French than they were made for the Germans in 1918. After all, the war against France has only lasted a month, and the war against Germany in 1914-18 lasted 4 years, and there is a somewhat larger opportunity for generosity after a successful one-month war than after all the bitterness and hatred and propaganda and atrocity mongering that goes on over a period of 4 years. But let's assume then that the conditions, at least as expressed to the French delegates, will not be onerous. It's perfectly obvious from those four preliminary conditions that Germany will exact from France everything she can possibly exact. Moreover, remember this, Germany is shrewd. She's going to delay the formal peace treaty until after the end of the war with England, until she sees what she's really able to get from France and from England, for Germany recognizes that the war is not yet over, that it has only just begun. Italy is going to have an armistice apart from Germany. She's going to work out her own terms. And you can depend upon it, the Italian terms will not be generous. They will probably insist on the occupation of certain French territory even before they begin to discuss the actual terms. The French fleet is still in French hands. Der Angriff in Berlin asserts that the 35,000-ton battleship Clemenceau and Richelieu have fallen to German hands, because the newspaper asserts that when they entered Brest, they found these battleships in the stocks at the great French naval building yards there. That, of course, is possible. But as far as the French fleet is concerned, there is every evidence that that will not fall into German hands insofar as evidence is available. Germany continues to penetrate France. We continue to discuss the union of the American republics in a great economic cartel in order to oppose unity to any economic action that may be taken from Europe. And here, one or two more comments. The demand for an investigation of the circumstances of Woodring's resignation and of Stimson's appointment, more congressional palaver. And Mr. Knox goes on in his statement and says, national defense is not a partisan question. Would that that were true. I repeat what I have said so many times. It is unfortunate that this country must be divided politically at a time when it should be united nationally. Good afternoon.
Mr. Kaltenborn will be heard again over most of these stations at this same time tomorrow. This is the National Broadcasting Company.